we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Let's begin with the alarming claims that Putin made during his State of the Nation address that Russia has developed an invincible missile that can reach anywhere in the world. How seriously should we take this?
We're not surprised by the statement, and the American people should rest assured that we are fully prepared.
In spite of all our protests, the U.S. machine is working at full speed. The conveyor is running full speed. They've deployed missile defense systems in Alaska and California. As a result of NATO eastward expansion, they've set up new two areas in Romania and Poland. Of course, every word here is important because we talked about missiles that are capable of bypassing, avoiding defensive barriers. We made no secret of our plans. We spoke openly of what we were about to do. We wanted to motivate our counterparts. This was in 2004, like I said, amazing. But despite of all the difficulties that we faced over the years, economic and financial problems, problems with our defense industry, with our armed forces, Russia remained a major nuclear power, but nobody wanted to talk to us seriously. They kept ignoring us. Nobody listened to us. So listen to us now.
How has it come to this? Almost three decades on from the end of the Cold War, how have we entered the most hostile and dangerous state of relations between Moscow and Washington there has ever been, including at any time during said Cold War? I won't lie, and I believe I speak for many in saying that when Vladimir Putin, during his address to the Russian Federal Assembly on March 1st in Moscow, unveiled Russia's new generation of nuclear weapons, designed and developed to overcome existing US missile defense capabilities, a part of me was glad. Glad over the fact that a necessary line was now being drawn by Russia against the juggernaut of unending war, regime change, and might is right, which has emanated from Washington since the demise of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. 800 military bases in 70 countries tells its own story when it comes to the extent of US hegemony, a projection of imperial power dressed up in the clothes of democracy, human rights, and global security. They claim, supporters of this American empire, that those bases are required to make the world safe for democracy. In truth, they are required to make the world safe for corporate greed, ensuring that Western global corporations are able to plunder the world's natural and human resources unimpeded by such trifling inconveniences as national borders, sovereignty, the right to self-determination, or cultural specificities. And make no mistake, those corporations have been plundering the planet, intoxicated with free market fundamentalist nostrums, demented with greed in their unending and rapacious drive for profits, regardless of the human, social, and environmental cost. So yes, a part of me, I admit, was glad to see finally a government and country with the ability and willingness to push back against this latter-day Roman Empire, not just refusing to bow to its writ, but asserting its right to be recognised as an equal in a world defined not by unipolarity, but by multipolarity. However, this being said, this development marks a lamentable point in our history. It describes the failure, the crushing failure, of those in power in Washington and the West to act in the interest of stability, peace, and mutual security in the post-Soviet world. It is evidence that for Western ideologues, the Cold War was not ended by mutual agreement between East and West, but rather it was won by them, and thus to the victor the spoils. Those spoils amounted to the expectation that Russia would now become another US vassal state, giving up its right to its own security and geopolitical interests. The country and its people were made the subject of a mass experiment in human despair, I should remind you, better known as free market shock treatment, turning its society and the lives of millions upside down almost overnight. overnight. The eastward expansion of NATO was undertaken in violation of verbal agreements to the contrary, as Washington set about imposing a Carthaginian peace with the clear objective of full spectrum dominance. Joseph St. Peter, in words written in the 1920s, described the machinations of the Roman Empire thus: "There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, the allies would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why, then it was the national honor that had been insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality." Substitute Washington for Rome in that passage, and you have the perfect summation of US foreign policy and its conceits in our time. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, I'm delighted to have George Zamuli back on the show to explore the significance of Putin's address to the Russian Federal Assembly. George is a senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute of London. He is also an author whose most recent work is Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War on Yugoslavia. George, welcome back to Hard Facts.
Yeah, how are you, John?
I'm very well. Now, it's significant. The last time you were on this show was in response to the speech made by US Defense Secretary James Mattis in January, during which he outlined the Trump administration's defense strategy, in which they fingered Russia and China as posing a threat to US interests, to global security, describing them both as revisionist states and authoritarian states. I would suggest to you that this is Russia's reply to that speech, though of course it goes deeper than that, because this missile technology has clearly been in gestation and development long before then. But the significance of the speech was when Putin identified US unilateral withdrawal from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty. And let me just quote the passage concerned from Putin's speech. Putin said, and I quote, "We did our best to dissuade the Americans from withdrawing from the treaty, all in vain. The US pulled out of the treaty in 2002. Even after that, we tried to develop constructive dialogue with the Americans. We proposed working together in this area to ease concerns and maintain the atmosphere of trust." He goes on, "All our proposals, absolutely all of them, were rejected." Your thoughts, please, George.
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. Because the 1972 ABM treaty was really the pride and joy of the arms control era. It was a crucial recognition by the two nuclear superpowers that a nuclear war cannot be fought and it therefore cannot be won. And, you know, by, you know, essentially foregoing any attempt to defend themselves from nuclear missiles, they were saying, look, the moment we're involved in any kind of a nuclear exchange, we are both destroyed, and therefore it makes no sense. So when the United States withdraws from the ABM treaty, then it's quite obvious why they're doing it. They're doing it in order to ensure that they will be able to use nuclear weapons and deny the right of Russia to defend itself. So it was always about achieving a first strike capability. In other words, that the United States could make a nuclear attack against Russia without getting any sort of effective response from Russia. So when Putin says, look, we are developing missiles that can avoid any missile defense systems, that it can overwhelm missile defense systems, he's saying, don't you even for one moment think that you can develop any sort of first strike capability, that you can actually start any small nuclear war and hope to prevail. We have the means to defend ourselves.
We have the means to defend ourselves, he said. You're right, George. But he also talked about his allies, Russia's allies, which I thought was hugely important in the context of the current era. He didn't just talk about Russia's security. He talked about the security of Russia's allies without actually naming who those allies could be, keeping the US guessing in that regard.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? That's a step change as far as Russia's concerned, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly was. It's because that's the sort of rhetoric that's, the Americans always talk about. Well, you know, our allies. Russia doesn't really talk about that. Russia just talks about, you know, the existential threat to us.
Yes.
You know, the Russian nation, the Russian fatherland. But allies was an interesting one. And I think that goes back to the situation in Syria, in which, you know, the Russians have been shot at by the Americans. And the Americans seem to be behaving with amazing irresponsibility and arrogance in Syria, thinking that they can shoot the Syrian government forces at will, attack Russians at will, and that there won't be any sort of response forthcoming from Russia. And I think he's pretty much saying that don't go down this road, don't play this game, because, you know, we will support our allies.
George, the entire inference of Western policy has been to deny that Russia has any kind of regional sphere of interest, while the US sphere of interest is the entire world. Thus, we had the attempt, well, not the attempt, we had the action of expanding NATO at warp speed eastward upon the reunification of Germany, and the attempt to use Georgia as a cat's paw in this regard in 2008, which was beaten back in that short-lived conflict. And the attempt to do so with regards to Ukraine in 2014, which is now still mired in crisis. What do you make of US policy? If you were being an objective observer, surely it's disastrous. It hasn't worked. They read the material conditions woefully inaccurately, i.e. that Russia was a defeated power. It would always remain defeated. It would be relegated to being a second or even third tier power. It had no ability to recover from the demise of the Soviet Union, and it would know its place as a US vassal state, which it was on its way to being under Boris Yeltsin. If you were a historian 50 years hence, how would you analyse US policy in this period?
Well, let's hope that there'll still be a universe in existence. Yeah. Well, I do think that the West did interpret the Cold War as a victory, a total victory, as if it were just simply a continuation of World War II, in which one side prevailed and the other side just simply handed in, you know, an unconditional surrender. That was the Western attitudes. And Russia's reemergence since 2000 has driven the U.S. policymakers crazy, because now there is a resistance to the U.S. global supremacy that you were talking about, this complete rampage around the world. And suddenly there is a coalition of powers that is resisting this. And this coalition of powers is led by Russia, which is why Russia has been targeted by the United States. And so if they figure that they can knock out Russia, then any kind of resistance to U.S. Hegemony will evaporate, and it probably will. As during the 1990s, there was absolutely no resistance whatever to U.S. hegemony, and, you know, things have only changed because of the rise of Russia. And what is particularly dangerous now is that there are clearly people in Washington.
George, can I just ask you to hold that thought for a second? We're at the break. I'm sorry, my friend. We'll continue this after the break. You're listening to George Zamouli. This is Hard Facts. We'll be back right after this. We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down in the company of George Zamouli. George is a senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute in London, and we are discussing the significance of Vladimir Putin's March 1st address to the Russian Federal Assembly in Moscow, during which, in dramatic fashion, he unveiled Russia's next generation of nuclear missiles, embracing hypersonic technology. Sorry, George, I had to cut you off. We were at the break. You were talking about how, if you were a historian looking back, how you would analyse US foreign policy towards Russia in the post-Soviet era. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes. So there are clearly policymakers in the Pentagon, but also in the State Department, who figure that Russia really is very weak. Russia is economically weak, and militarily it's rather weak compared to the United States. So they figure that in any kind of armed confrontation between the United States and Russia, the United States will win pretty easily. And that therefore the only resort Russia would have in such a confrontation is to escalate to nuclear weapons. And they figure that the Russians wouldn't do anything so insane. And then at that moment, they will realize that they can't possibly compete with the United States as a global power. And they will just give up and unilaterally surrender and accept U.S. global supremacy without ever daring to challenge it again. This is a very dangerous calculation. In fact, I think it's a miscalculation because Russia, it's not in Russia's nature just to give up like that. It's happened, one or two times in the past, but they are usually aberrations. And Russia's really not in the mood now to, surrender in such an implacid fashion. So I do think that the thinking in Washington is going to lead to a very dangerous confrontation. The moment anyone thinks that they can prevail in some kind of an armed conflict, is that's a moment of serious danger for the world.
Now, it was only to be expected, George, that this unveiling of Russia's next generation of nuclear missiles would be dismissed, or summarily dismissed, in fact, in Washington. The mantra was that we knew about this all the time, that we have the ability to overcome this, that Russia will not be able to deal with what we have in our arsenal, and so on and so forth. But in reality, how do you think this will have been going down in the Pentagon and in the corridors of power in Washington? Panic?
I think so. I think that they're suddenly seeing this real power. I mean, all this time, they've been essentially been very dismissive of Russia. They think that they can shoot at them, and send weapons into Ukraine, and Russia will just simply back up down. Suddenly seeing these missiles, these are big, powerful missiles, would have certainly focused their attention. And it would have realized that this is serious business.
Will it produce a change in the policy?
No, I don't think
Can they afford to back down? Will it bring them to the negotiating table in good faith?
No, I don't think so. I do think that the America is in this moment that they figure that they can somehow eliminate Russia as a rival, that they'll never get as great an opportunity as now. I mean, they're still somehow thinking that provoking some sort of a confrontation with Russia, and Russia will be defeated, Russia will back down, and that will be the end of Russia's pretensions to being a global rival to the United States. I don't think there's any mood in Washington to negotiate, to go back to arms control agreements. Washington is hell-bent on some kind of a confrontation with Russia. I don't see any forces at all that are pushing against this in any effective fashion.
I think it's not an overstatement to make the point, George, that we are closer now to direct military confrontation between East and West than we have ever been at any time, including during the Cold War, perhaps with the exception of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. It is a lamentable period that we've entered with Putin's address. It has to be said. I'm minded of Eisenhower's quote when he said that every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. So I'm kind of schizophrenic on this. I did say in my introduction I was glad to see Russia drawing the line, given my view of politics and geopolitics and the way that the US has been an uncontrolled juggernaut, spreading death and destruction around the globe since the demise of the Soviet Union. But it is lamentable, don't you think, George?
Of course it is. Of course it's a gigantic
failure.
Waste of resources.
It's a failure of policymakers in our time. And I'm pointing the finger right at the West for this, not Russia. Russia's responding. It's Vladimir Putin has gone out of his way to foment positive working relations, a partnership with his counterparts in Washington. And every attempt has been rebuffed in the most humiliating and insulting way. So What is it that intoxicate these people, George? I've asked this question many times. I've attempted with guest after guest to undertake a psychological profile of these people, these neocons, on both left and right of the political spectrum in Washington. When I say left, I'm talking about the liberal establishment. I'm not talking about the real left. I'm talking about the liberal establishment, the Clintonites and so forth. You live in the US. You have been there many, 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 many years. What have you come up with in this regard, this ideology, this obsession with total power and total domination?
Yes, it is really, on the face of it, almost inexplicable. Kind of the arrogant belief in ruling over the entire world, of going to any country anywhere in the world and telling them what to do. Telling them what economic policies they should pursue, what kind of social policies they should pursue, what kind of weapon systems they should have, where they should buy them, what kind of government they should have, who could enter the government, who can't enter the government. They love this feeling of power. And they've reached this point that, you know, following the collapse of the Soviet Union, and they do not want to give that up. So back in, you know, in the days of the Cold War, with a kind of divided world, I mean, the West couldn't do these things because, and therefore there was any number of powers had a considerable amount of leeway and an ability to pursue an independent course because there was a rival superpower.
The world still operated essentially, sorry to interrupt, George, the world still operated essentially according to Westphalian principles, the balance of power.
That's right.
Regardless of what you think of the other countries or other blocs' ideology or how they organise their societies, you respected that balance of power. And it stopped one country or one set of country or one constellation of states assuming too much power and thereby abusing that power, which is exactly what happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, exactly. And that was it. And so the moment the Soviet Union collapsed, the West seized the chance to expand indefinitely. I mean, it was, you know, like within minutes, it was already pushing for NATO expansion in Europe. Within minutes, it was essentially dictating economic policies to the rest of the world. And the West saw it that this is our moment to achieve total dominance over the entire planet. And now that there's some kind of a pushback, and really it's Russia can't really do everything on it by itself. I mean, it's still, you know, it's a power of, it's a limited power. I mean, it can't possibly take on the United States, NATO. I mean, it's much smaller and weaker in comparison. But, you know, the fact that Russia is pushing back, it has formed some kind of a global coalition of pushing back. This is enough to just drive Washington crazy. The idea that this somehow their desire for total dominance is under challenge. I mean, recall that during the first Cold War, I mean, you could have made a reasonable case that, either the West started it or started under Stalin, the Soviet Union, whatever. I mean, you could have made an argument for on both sides. Here, there can be no question who started this new Cold War. I mean, that was Russia had absolutely no interest whatever in pursuing any policies hostile to the West. It had an economy that it had to work on.
Well, it had to try and reconstruct the country. I mean, the country was in disarray. The country was in turmoil. And the West took advantage of that turmoil. And that adds an extra level of mendacity to what happened in the West position. When these free market fundamentalists descended on the country and teamed up with free market converts in Russia to try and plunder the country's wealth. Well, they didn't try, they did. And here's a startling statistic, which is a withering indictment of that period. In 1989, before the demise of the Soviet Union, according to the World Bank, 4 million Russians were living in poverty. By 1998, that number had gone up to 74 millions.
Yes.
74
yes.
millions.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
This is a crime of the ages that was inflicted on the Russian people, George.
That's right. No, exactly. And it was very interesting that when Putin began his crackdown on the oligarchs who had just robbed Russia blind, the West just responded with fury. How dare you go after Khodorkovsky? How dare you go after Kuczynski? How dare you? These are decent people. Or Browder. How dare you go after these people? And then, you know, they Westerners just think of these are somehow, these are democratic human rights freedom fighters. I mean, these are absolute crooks who robbed Russia blind. And yet they enjoy the support of the Western governments.
George, there's another aspect to this that strikes me. I don't know if it strikes you, but if you consider that at the time of the Russian Revolution in 1917, 80% of Russia was peasant. It was a peasant economy, 80% illiterate. 100 years on, this technology has been unveiled. The most cutting-edge technology, regardless of the purpose. We've already discussed how, in a very real sense, it's a lamentable period in our history that we've just entered with this address and with this unveiling. But on the level of technology, on the level of science, this is a remarkable achievement on the part of Russia, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, you know, when you think of the Soviet Union, there was a remarkable achievement, you know, the fact that they were able, first of all, during World War II, to smash to smithereens the Nazi war machine, and then subsequently to develop a quite impressive space program. I mean, it was at least the equal of that of the United States. So the scientific technological achievements of the Soviet Union was remarkable. In fact, Putin made that point during his address to the Federal Assembly.
What do you attribute that achievement to, George? Is it something implicit within communism, within communist planning, within the emphasis that communism places on development? What do you attribute that achievement to?
Well, there was some of that. I mean, there was clearly a strong patriotic element, the communists were able to mobilize, and particularly during World War II, but then subsequently, it was, sometimes you see it in Soviet cinema, in which there is the strong ethos of doing everything that you can in order to in science and engineering and technical development, you know, that's all for our country. And so there was a great, you know, patriotic fervor, patriotic pride that communists were able to mobilize.
Now, you're a well-known Russia expert of considerable repute. How was this address playing in Russia? Did it go down well? And what kind of bearing will it have on the upcoming presidential election?
Well, I think it's gone down well. And I think Putin will prevail comfortably in the election. But, you know, he does have a problem, which is, you know, he is a man who is very cautious. He's not given to wild exaggerations, hyperbole. You know, he's not Donald Trump. He's not even Nikita Khrushchev. I mean, he's a somewhat phlegmatic man, and therefore he's slow to respond. And there is clearly criticism bubbling in Russia that he has been a little too slow, a little bit too cautious in responding to Western provocations. So, you know, when, you know, the Russians hear about Russians getting killed in Syria, and, you know, the Russian government kind of, somewhat mute in its response, they get a little anxious. They get a little annoyed. They want to know what's going on here. Why are we responding in this, pusillanimous manner? And, I mean, Putin, it's understandable. Putin does not want to get provoked into any kind of a war. But, you know, he does have a problem. I mean, he is going to come under pressure to do something and not allow, the West just to push him around in this way.
George, we've come right to the end of the show. Thank you for your insight and your analysis.
Well, thank you very much.
If the West had declared a new Cold War, and if James Mattis's speech was the official declaration of that Cold War on the part of Washington, Vladimir Putin's March 1st address to the Russian Federal Assembly proves that that war has been joined. You've been listening to George Zamouli. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.